from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Walter Isaacson offered insight into the mind of Apple's iconic founder, Steve Jobs, in his 2011 biography. He's also written best-selling biographies of Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and Henry Kissinger. His new book goes back in time to look at a different kind of creative genius, Leonardo da Vinci. The longtime journalist and president of the Aspen Institute joins us to talk about the man who sketched flying machines when people still relied on horses and carts and envisioned a different kind of future. It's coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Leonardo da Vinci may be known for painting Mona Lisa's mysterious smile, but he's also credited with some of the earliest drawings of flying machines, and he envisioned the helicopter, parachute, and tank in the 15th century, nearly 500 years before the first helicopter even took to the skies. He's been called the original Renaissance man, a creative genius, and he's the subject of a new biography by Walter Isaacson. Walter Isaacson has written biographies of Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and he joins us to talk about his new book on the painter and much more, Leonardo da Vinci. Welcome back to Forum.
It's good to be back at this wonderful room.
Pleased to have you in this wonderful room, which can give you claustrophobia, one of my friends said recently, but it is wonderful for all we like to think that we do here.
It's a very expansive room.
And you are an expansive author. I mean, to take on a character, and by the way, I mentioned Walter Isaacson is also president and CEO of the Aspen Institute and was head of CNN and was chief editor of Time magazine. He's got quite a CV himself. But to take on a subject like Leonardo, I mean, despite all of these other extraordinary biographies that you have produced and that have become a part of really our American canon, there's just something about writing about someone whose mind was so capacious and who was so restless all the time with thinking of different things and who covered so much territory and was one of our greatest artists and one of our greatest scientists, too.
I mean, and just, I don't think he made much of a distinction between art and engineering. Getting back to Steve Jobs or the others I've written about, it's those people whose mind can range across, all right, let me do a beautiful bird in flight. Let me figure out how birds fly. Let me do a notebook on the flight of birds. And then let me do flying machines. He loved all these patterns in nature. And the really cool thing was that his engineering and his art were just sort of ways of seeing the beauty of nature.
And you mentioned a notebook, about 7,000 pages that mm-hmm. really show, again, that wide, unbelievable range of his mind, which became an important source for you, I know. You also got a book from Steve Jobs up in Seattle that...
No, Bill Gates.
I mean, Bill Gates, excuse me.
We confused the two.
Easy
to know. Well, Bill Gates bought the Codex Lester, which is one of Leonardo's notebooks, probably the greatest of his scientific notebooks. And it's glorious because it's everything from the measurement of the sun to how shadows are formed, to water, to how fossils and how the waters get to the top of mountains. And it's so important to understand the Codex Lester because it's part of what Leonardo is doing while he's painting the Mona Lisa, which is understanding not only everything there is to know about nature, but also how do we fit into it. And so almost the waters flowing into the back of Mona Lisa and that painting sort of spring, so to speak, from the Codex Lester. And Bill Gates bought it a while back, 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, I had the chance, like many people have, because he's very generous, to see the notebook. And he's got a great curator and a great team that's working on translations of it. And so they helped me with my translations that I used in the book and helped me understand the science and geology that's in that notebook. And what I tried to do is tie it into everything else about Leonardo. Because when we make a distinction and we treat Leonardo mainly as an artist or mainly as an engineer, we're making the mistake that he never made in his life, which is to silo things.
Well, when he, for example, decided that he wanted to go from Tuscany to Milan and applied to Ludovico, who was essentially
the acting duke.
The ruler, yeah. He presented himself largely as a military engineer. It was kind of an inflated resume of himself, and just kind of mentioned at the end, well, I can do paintings too.
It's the greatest job application letter in history, but it also is a wonderful window into the mind of Leonardo. He had reached that unnerving milestone of turning 30. And so there he is, having a really good-looking guy, not, you know, loving Florence, but his father's there as a notary, and a couple of the paintings that Leonardo was supposed to do in Florence, that his father had notarized the contracts, like the Adoration of the Magi, he hasn't finished. Now, if you know anybody with 20-something kids, you know the problem when they kind of don't, you know, finish the things they're supposed to do. So Leonardo basically goes to Milan, part of a delegation, of cultural delegation, soft power, where the Medici are sending musicians and playwrights and poets and artists. Leonardo goes carrying a musical instrument as a musician, but then writes a job application letter to the Duke and says, an 11-paragraph letter, and the first 10 paragraphs are, I can build great public buildings. I can make weapons of war. I have engineering skills that allow me to do these types of machinery. You know, I know how to divert the course of rivers, and he does his hydraulics engineering. And only in the last paragraph, number 11, he says, I can also paint and sculpt as well as any man. And, of course, he could. He goes on, does the Last Supper. But it shows two things about him. One, that he thinks of himself as an engineer and painter and doesn't make much of a distinction. And secondly, he does fantasize a bit. And I thought, well, that's a bit uncool. You know, he's not really that good of an engineer, especially at age 30. And yet then I realize it's the fantasy and this mix of fantasy and reality that allows him to envision things like helicopters and flying machines that won't actually get made then, but a very futuristic, and we should do that in our kids, is let them fantasize a bit.
See, Nick Haraway says at the end of The Great Gatsby, I turned 30 today, I'm too old to lie to myself anymore. That age of 30 was very different then.
But that was different then. Leonardo still got to lie to himself in a way, but that allowed him to stretch his imagination.
It's also thinking, though, about how much, you know, keep emphasizing this non-siloed world of engineering and art and how they were so connected in that world of Leonardo's, but especially for him. But going to Milan allowed him to do all this scenery and all this sort of stuff that really would become part of his paintings.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Michael, is that most of what he did early in his career was pageants, plays, sceneries, props, for the performances that were put on by the Medici, but then mainly the Duke of Milan. It's before TV. It's before the internet. It's before movies. So in the evenings, what happens in the court of Milan is great debates are held on stage, great performances of plays, wonderful public spectacles and pageants. And that was an important job to have, just like Joseph Papp doing Shakespeare in the Park. You know, but we don't remember that because it's not like the Mona Lisa where we have a good record of it. But in his notebooks, I discover all these plays and pageants, and even that helicopter you mentioned, that begins as a prop for a play that he's choreographing, and it's designed to take the angels down from heaven onto the stage. But the fantasy he does for the theater then translates into the real world, and he says, well, let me try that in reality. Likewise, if you look at a stage production, it's very dramatic movement of the characters and the scenery comes in a perspective that, and then you look at the Last Supper and you say, oh yeah, look at the walls. It almost looks like scenery, accelerated perspective. And the table is slanted as if it's on stage and the characters are making exaggerated gestures. And you see the moment flowing of Christ saying, one of you shall betray me. And it flows out among the disciples. So that theatrical production I discovered was immensely important to his imagination.
And you've done such a good job here, Walter, with the paintings. I mean, not only giving us a sense of all the nuances and all that went into envisioning these paintings, because most people are just familiar probably with The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, and yet some of these paintings are just so extraordinary, and they're in the book.
I want to give Simon Schuster real quick a shout-out. Because, like Steve Jobs, it's like, okay, sometimes create a product that's more beautiful than necessary. Simon & Schuster decided in doing this book to use heavy 80 stock paper, pure white with really good coating. So the book's not that long. It's, you know, less than 500 pages. But it's heavy because these are full-color illustrations throughout. And that's costly.
500 pages is a big tome nowadays.
Well, it's I've had biographies that are longer. But it's full-color pictures throughout, so that when you're reading about, say, the baptism of Christ and seeing the rippling of the water by his ankles, the picture's right there. And they kept the price down to the price below that of most biographies now. And I just want to give them credit, because it was really good of them to make a book that was phenomenally beautiful with, you know, the color illustrations. So they're not all crammed on those glossy pages sometimes you have in the middle of the book where they cram 16 pages of pictures. It's like every page has it. And I just appreciate a publisher.
No, it's a beautiful
book.
Work. And congratulations on it. Quite an extraordinary career you've had as a biographer. We can get to that, I hope. But, you know, there's something about having these paintings in the book that gives life to them. And, I mean, especially with you're giving life to Leonardo the way you do. But I was also struck by the fact that so many paintings never were completed. And, you know, the reality is he was a guy who a lot of times just didn't get the job done because his mind was going so many different directions.
I know. I think he probably had a falling out with his father on that, as I describe in the book, because his father was a notary for some of these painting contracts, and he doesn't finish the Adoration of the Magi.
Excuse me, he would not have been a notary if he was not illegitimate. I mean, he might have been a notary if he was not an illegitimate son.
Right, right. He was lucky to be illegitimate because his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather were all notaries. But being born out of wedlock meant that he couldn't inherit the family notary trade. And also didn't go to university, so he got to think across disciplines, be a disciple of his own learning and experience. And
he was also left-handed, which was sort of sinestre, you know, at the
sinestre.
Time.
Sinestre. And he was a vegetarian. He was slightly heretical, born out of wedlock, gay.
And gay.
And so he was lucky he was born in Florence, or born near Florence and moves to Florence, because, first of all, it was an incredibly tolerant city. It reminds me so much of San Francisco. Florence in 1470 and San Francisco in 1970 have an explosion of, you know, the free speech movement, the electric Kool-Aid acid tests, the hippies, but also homebrew computer clubs. Likewise, in Florence, you have a new printing industry. You have people being openly gay and, you know, feeling fit right in.
Although, forgive me, I mean, that breaks down when you think Leonardo went to jail for sodomy. Didn't he?
Well, he gets arrested for sodomy and may have spent a night in jail because it was a second offense. Fortunately, among the people with him was one of the Medici family members, so he gets out right away. And he never has a real problem being, he has a boyfriend, first Atalante Maggiore, who's a musician with whom he goes to Milan, and then famously Salai, which is his
little
nickname.
Sticky fingers.
Yeah, it means the little devil because he kept nicking things. And when they're all friends are getting together for dinner to do Vitruvian Man, because that's done with a group of friends that had visited Pavia. There's Salai who spills wine on the table. So we get a lot about Salai, including a lot of drawings of Salai in Leonardo's notebooks. And so Leonardo felt comfortable. In fact, the word in German for gay in that period was Florenzer, because people from Florence were so tolerant of everything, not just being gay, but being different. And we have to understand, when you look at a city like San Francisco, you look at a city like Florence 500 years earlier, tolerance is a key part of getting people of different and diverse talents to rub together, which is how creativity occurs.
Well, I want to talk to you about creativity, but he came to Florence in 1502 mm-hmm. and met with Caesar Borgia, no less. And Machiavelli plays a role.
You know, man, if they're going to do a movie of this book, that's the scene.
Wait a minute. Leonardo DiCaprio, I think, has the rights. He wants to play Leonardo.
Well, I know very little about Hollywood, but I will say that the scene of the three of them, Machiavelli, Caesar Borgia, and Leonardo, working together for 4 months in the winter of, I think, 1502, and they're holed up in a tiny town called Imola, And Leonardo, who's been doing, you know, thinks he can be an engineer of military weapons, realizes that the best military weapon he can give is doing three-dimensional looking maps with an aerial view, which he's able to pace off this tiny town of Imola and do something that allows a military defender a great advantage. If you have a perfect map of every building, every street, every stream. And I once went to the Defense Mapping Agency in near Washington, and the maps look somewhat similar to what Leonardo did for Caesar Borgia that winter. And Machiavelli, of course, has taken the notes, eventually writes to the prince about Borgia. But Leonardo was a bit of a pacifist, a vegetarian, as we said. After 4 months, he just throws it in. He realizes he should not be serving the warlord.
He saw a lot of terrible violence. I mean, they were decapitating.
Yes. It was. It's odd. I mean, everybody has their psychological complexities. And Leonardo, very friendly as a pacifist, would walk through the markets and see caged birds and buy them so that he could let them free and watch them fly. So he's a gentle person of great friendliness. And yet there's a little bit of a dark side swirling in him. Maybe search for the father figure where he decides to serve this warlord for a while until he gets fed up and quits and goes back to Florence.
It's also in that same context or vein, you write about all of the, controversy over whether to leave the statue of David naked or not.
You know, he didn't get along well with Michelangelo. You can imagine Michelangelo, about 20 years younger, sort of the new hot artist in Florence. Leonardo was so friendly and had a lot of young artists around him. It would be nice to imagine what would have happened had they become friends. But Michelangelo was a very petulant, reclusive, and somewhat nasty person. And he kept dissing, you know, Leonardo when they'd run into each other in the plazas of Florence. So when Michelangelo does David with the huge statue, Leonardo's on the committee to figure out where to place it, and he votes to stash it away under what are now the arches of the Uffizi, and to put a decent ornament on it. I have in the book not only the beautiful statue of David, but Leonardo's notebook drawing from the committee meeting where he puts a fig leaf over the genitals of David, and that's the way they displayed it for the first 40 years. So it's interesting. One of the cool things about writing biography is you realize these people are human. They do things like make mistakes and serve a warlord and then have to quit. Or they get into rivalries with Michelangelo. Or in Leonardo's case, one of the notebook pages I love is in his 30s after he's done this Duke of Milan thing and et cetera, he has a recipe for dyeing his hair blonde, boiling nuts and oil, because he has these beautiful blonde curls. He's the self-portrait in Vitruvian Man, that beautiful body and curling hair. But you get a sense of his own insecurities and feelings.
Talk a bit more, though, about where the creativity comes from in your judgment, because obviously it's allied with your belief in, we supposedly have two cultures, according to Snow Levis, of art and science and so forth. But the reality is you see them not only converging in his mind, but this great curiosity that he had. So where's the tie-in to creativity? How does creativity emerge from that?
I think being self-taught gave him lesson number one in creativity, which is be curious, always be curious for curiosity's sake. One of the things on his to-do list, besides figure out how to measure the size of the sun, or why is the sky blue, or why do people yawn, or which muscles move the lips, he writes these to-do lists of things he wants to know. One of them is, describe the tongue of the woodpecker. I go, what? Why would somebody wake up one morning and want to know? How would you find out? But it was out of pure curiosity that he did these things. So lesson one is pure curiosity, which I think partly comes from being just a curious kid, but it partly comes from not having gone to school or formal schooling, so he has to be self-taught. Secondly is be observant, which connects to that. In my last chapter of my book, I do 20 of these lessons, but lesson two is be observant, because he'll say, go down to the moat by the castle and look at the four-winged dragonflies to see if their wings alternate when it flies or they go in unison. And that's something any of us could do. But you and I, when we see a dragonfly, probably don't pause to observe it carefully. And that's lesson two on how to be creative, is observe things that we quit observing after we outgrow our wonder years at age 10 or 12. And all the way through, but the main lesson, as you said, is be open to the beauties of all fields, whether it's math or music, like Leonardo.
Well, it says something,
art or engineering.
I was just saying, it may be revelatory about public education in this sense. There was always this belief that Shakespeare couldn't have written Shakespeare. It had to be Marlowe or King John or something.
Because which he is was incorrect.
Too, well, of course, but he was too plebeian or something. And, you know, when you think about just the underprivileged nature of Leonardo in terms of his education and so forth, it all really came out of his autodidacticism.
Right. So he's totally self-taught. And he's so lucky because just as if he had been born 500 years later in San Francisco when the Internet was coming up, he's born just as Gutenberg's printing press is starting to spread. So among the lists in his notebooks, besides, you know, describe the tongue of the woodpecker or why do people yawn, are find the translation of Euclid that's at the stationer's next to the bridge. You know, find Vitruvius's 10 books of architecture that are, you know, available in Pavia. And so he's finding these wonderful books and just seeking out knowledge for its own sake.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Walter Isaacson, who delves into the mind of another genius. This time it's Leonardo da Vinci. Did you go from Jobs to da Vinci in a kind of natural or organic way?
You know, one of the things that Leonardo is so good at is spotting patterns. You know, he'll walk through and see a whirlwind of air and a curl of hair and water flowing into a bowl. And he'll say those spirals have the same pattern. He'll even do a stab at the Fibonacci equation or whatever, the math behind it. It took me a while to figure out the pattern. I had done Benjamin Franklin, another autodidact, never went to college, had to teach himself, who loves every field from flying a kite to figure out what electricity is to publishing Poor Richard's Almanac and being a journalist. And after doing Franklin and then Einstein, who was a great, you know, loved music and played Mozart whenever he was stymied with the equations of general relativity, and then Steve Jobs, who, as you know, at the end of every product presentation would show street signs of the intersection of art and technology, I eventually, I'm not as smart as Leonardo, figured out the pattern, which is I love minds that cross different disciplines and that help and that ability to love both math and music, like Ada Lovelace loved both poetry and processors.
You have to have a pretty exceptional mind, though, to get in the minds of these people, especially Einstein, Jobs, and Leonardo. We're talking to Walter Isaacson. He also wrote a biography of Kissinger. And we welcome your involvement in the program. Thoughts about creativity, about genius, about Leonardo. Your questions and comments are welcome. And let me tell you how you can join the program. Our toll-free number is available. And by the way, Walter will be at Kepler's this evening in Menlo Park at 7:30. He's also CEO of the Aspen Institute and former chair of CNN and former managing editor of Time magazine. Join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your questions, your comments. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, or go to our Facebook page. But feel free to join the program and the conversation. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Walter Isaacson, who has written a biography of the true Spencerian man, Leonardo da Vinci. And certainly welcome your involvement in the program. Number of ways to join us: by email, by going to our website, or by calling us. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. We talk a little bit about the Mona Lisa because, as you point out in the book, this was probably done for a wife of a silk merchant, but he at the time could have done for the richest person.
Isabella d'Este, the richest woman in Italy, is begging him and saying, I'll pay anything, do my portrait. And he didn't dance to the music of patrons. He decided that Lisa, the wife of a cloth merchant, had a certain mysterious beauty and decided to take that commission. And, of course, never delivered it because he takes a commission in 1503. In 1519, when he dies, it's by his bedside in France because he's always thinking, there's one more stroke I can add that'll make that smile more perfect.
In fact, the fascination in the notebooks with smiles comes across, too, for you.
You know, he dissects the human face to get every muscle that touches the lips, including figuring out that the bottom lip is a muscle, but the top lip can't move independently, and how the nerves all go. He also dissects the human eye to figure out if you see something directly at the center of your retina, you see the details, but in the if you're looking slightly from an angle, you see colors and shadows. So he makes the Mona Lisa smile. If you look directly at it, some of the details make it look like she's not really smiling. But as your eye wanders to her cheek or chin or forehead, the smile pops on. So it's augmented reality. It's interactive and it's elusive. It's a smile. The more you look for it, the less you see it. So these people who say he wasted time doing optics and dissections and everything else, I say, no, the Mona Lisa answers that criticism with her smile.
There's a local, and our show is broadcast throughout the country, and actually we have listeners online across the Atlantic and so forth, but actually a friend of mine, Leonard Schlein, did a biography of...
Right. Well, he did a wonderful learning from... what you can learn from how the mind works, which is interesting.
He also did a book called Art and Physics. So, again, mm-hmm. you know, there's that juxtaposition or that connection between the two.
And I think a lot, you know, Arthur Miller out of London has also done art and physics books and stuff. I think that if you appreciate Einstein, you appreciate Leonardo, even Benjamin Franklin, who was not a genius in the way that an Einstein or Leonardo was, but he just... love the connection of science and humanities. It's a wonderful, wonderful way of looking at the world.
I wonder, though, and I want to get back to Leonardo, but when I read Einstein and we talked about it, I thought, you know, there's an old saying, if you understand quantum mechanics, you either have to be crazy or a genius. And yet you were able to understand quantum
mechanics? No, I will. I think I got general relativity and special relativity. I think it was Richard Feynman said, nobody understands quantum mechanics. And there's a, because even Einstein, on his deathbed, couldn't fathom this notion that in a quantum mechanical world, things happen not according to strict causation laws, but they happen by chance, by probability at the subatomic level. And he famously keeps saying, I cannot believe that God plays dice with the universe. On his deathbed, he's still writing equations that are trying to get a unified theory that will bring together the mysteries of quantum mechanics with the certainties of the laws that define general relativity.
Unified field theory.
Yes, and, you know, let me, if I may, make a diversion here. One of the things that inspired me was looking at those last pages of Einstein as he's dying in Princeton. I even went to Hebrew University to go look at the originals. And he's still, even though he knows he's dying, he's in an aorta that's ruptured, they're not going to operate, he's still writing until the pain makes it too great and he dribbles off line after line of equations to get the unified theory, as if he could get us one step closer to the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe as he was dying. When Leonardo is very old and in France and his heart is failing, he had a puzzle that his whole life he had tried to deal with. You can see it reflected in Vitruvian Man. It's the ancient puzzle of trying to square the circle, to make a circle the exact same size as a square, the same area, using only a ruler and a protractor. Protractor. And his last notebook page from France, there's four more drawings, right triangles, some trick Euclid had tried to use, varying the lengths of the legs of the triangle. And he has a little chart. And then as he gets near the end of the page, just where Einstein was, two-thirds of the way down the page, it breaks off and he says, but the soup is getting cold. And you imagine that he's been called downstairs by his cook, Mathurine. His students and colleagues are all waiting for him to eat the midday meal. And he's still trying to square the circle, even though he's dying, but the soup is getting cold.
It's a lovely story. I want to get to our callers and emails. Quick thing, though. Mm-hmm. Some, when I think about Einstein, particularly now, prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
Da Vinci, prophetic. You could even say in some ways, certainly Kissinger and Steve Jobs were prophetic. I mean, there is that element of the visionary quality to
all
these.
You have to be visionary, yeah.
Let's bring in our listeners, and let me begin with Phil. Phil, you're up. Good morning.
Good morning. Great show. You know, on the avenue of truth speaks to power, these independent thinkers have problems. So, for example, Galileo, when he confirmed the Copernican theory that the Earth rotates around the sun, was convicted by the Roman Inquisition. And then when he published his second opus, Proving Tides, he was convicted a second time and then confined to his home. So I'd be very curious to hear, you know, the hostile environments to these independent thinkers.
Yes, and they do have to speak truth to power. And more importantly, they have to question received wisdom. I mean, whether it's Steve Jobs saying, here's to the misfits, the rebels, the round pegs in the square hole, those who think different, to Einstein, who's looking at the first paragraph of Newton's Principia, which tells us that time marches along irrespective of how we observe it, and Einstein saying, how do we know that? Let me question that. Leonardo is very, very good at that. It comes from the fact that he's self-taught and a disciple of experience. I can give you many examples. I'll give you two or three, which is, you know, the story of the biblical flood taught by the church. He studies fossils. He looks at layer and layer of sediment and fossils in it. He even discovers, the first to discover, trace fossils, which means not the fossil of an organism, but of the trace the organism left. So he knows it was alive when that trace was made. And he even paints it in Virgin of the Rocks beautifully. So he writes in his notebooks and says, no, the biblical flood did not happen. It didn't work that way. These things were over thousands of years. Likewise, he does the fetus in the womb, the beautiful, beautiful drawing, which is the frontispiece of my book. And he says, oh, but it's viable. It's not viable out of the womb because it's getting nutrition and it's not breathing on its own, and questions, you know, when viability occurs in the womb. There's so many things where he questions the teachings of the church. And fortunately for him, at that period, let us say the church is not overly strict. We talked about Caesar Borgia. He's the son of a pope. Now, you think about it for a minute. Hey, how do popes, you know, are supposed to be celibate? So it was a time when there were a lot of Medici and Borgias who were popes. And so there was, it's why the Reformation is starting to happen then, because the church isn't all that strict. And Leonardo gets to resist, to some extent, the teachings of the church while still learning the teachings of the church.
I'm going to bring on more callers for our guest, Walter Isaacson, whose new book is Leonardo da Vinci. And let me go to a few comments from listeners, though. Whenever we have a biography of a genius, what comes up is who they borrow from or what did they borrow. Mm-hmm. And so how originally are they and how collegial were they in terms of partnerships or working with teams and so forth. And I've got those two listeners who address right. both of those points. Let me just read what they write. Ben writes, I read somewhere Da Vinci had many educated people working under him. Doesn't that mean his genius might be owed to his very talented disciples? And Jeff writes, just a couple of months ago, there was a documentary on, I believe PBS, which characterized Da Vinci as a great borrower of the ideas of others. Just curious as to the guest's comments.
Both are absolutely right, and Leonardo would be the first to say so. He was the most collegial of all, you know, geniuses of the time. He loved working in the court of Milan, where his best friend is Luca Pacioli, the mathematician, and they do, you know, shapes together. Leonardo does the drawings, but he's always asking in his notebooks. He'll say, Luca Pacioli taught me how to do cube roots and roots, and then he'll have a friend who's an astronomer, teaches the measurement of the sun. He very much annotates even the books he reads and the ideas he gets, the weapons of war done from Valtrius and some other people whose books he bought. And that's one of the things I learned over the years in writing about geniuses, is we biographers have a dirty secret, which is we distort history sometimes by making it seem like genius or creativity is a guy or a gal going to a garage or garret all alone and a light bulb moment happens. No, even at Apple, it wasn't just Steve Jobs, it was a team. Certainly if you look at all the great things in the Bay Area from Intel to Google or whatever, it's teams of people who do it. Leonardo loved putting together groups of people. I have a whole chapter on how Vitruvian Man, for example, the guy in the circle and square, was done with four friends who were working on the Milan Cathedral. Then they go to Pavia to make a more simple church. They read Vitruvius's 10 books on architecture. They each draw the man and the proportions of man compared to a church. And Leonardo, of course, does the memorable of all the drawings. But this, he knew that creativity was a team sport.
Well, this is a team program, and we're going to hear from more of our listeners. Let me get Paul on next. Paul, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call and for the time of the show. I'm a local sculptor and have a couple of questions. Sorry for my – I'm not a native speaker, so sorry for the way I formulate the questions. First of all, I'm interested in his concept of the role of solitude in observation. And perhaps the second one, if you have time, is the role of physical body involvement in absorbing knowledge. The reason I ask that is because this is why I'm a sculptor, because I think it's very important, and we're sight-sitting a lot of this these days because of technology. I'm not against technology. I just feel they shouldn't be mutually exclusive. So perhaps you have some answers, and I really appreciate it.
Solitude. Leonardo wrote about it in a romantic way. He did a treatise on how to be a great artist and creator, and he says sometimes you need solitude, should go off into the countryside and be alone. Like a lot of the advice that Leonardo gave, he didn't actually believe it that deeply. He was somebody who very rarely sought out solitude. Occasionally he'd go to the countryside outside of Milan to visit the family of his companion Melzi, but he more enjoyed working around a lot of people of different and diverse talents. And there are other parts of his notebook where he says you have to surround yourself with creative people because that's where great ideas happen. In terms of the physical nature of things, Leonardo was quite comfortable with technology. I mean, he was always building machines.
You see him as one of the seminal technologists, really, don't you?
Right. And he, especially on mechanics, I mean, we don't have electronics, obviously, back then, but he loved mechanical devices that would do everything from fly to make angels in a theater performance fly. When he was a young kid, just like in his, 12 or 13 years old in Verrocchio's studio, he did the tech, worked on the technology to solder using mirrors that concentrated the sun's light rays, a copper ball to put on top of the dome of Florence's cathedral, the Duomo, that Brunelleschi had designed the dome, and they were supposed to put the copper ball on top. So Leonardo draws all the machinery, and 30 years later in his notebooks, he's still saying, remember how we did the mirrors that were able to solder the ball on the dome of the cathedral.
Speaking of technology, I'd like to get your thoughts about something, and it ties in with my question before about being prophetic and visionary. I mean, you've been in these great minds, and you've lived their lives. And when I interviewed Ray Kurzweil, who's now at Google, he was talking about Leonardo, and he was saying, Leonardo envisioned us flying it at the time. Who would have thought 747s and so forth? Mm-hmm. And he sort of attached that to the idea that we would never conceive of immortality, but now, mm-hmm. of course, we can. And it brings me right to something else that I want to, because I know you've been concerned about this, and so is Elon Musk, artificial intelligence. It's a great concern to Musk. He says it's more of a concern to him than North Korea or Iran or anything like that.
Yeah, there are two schools of thought when it comes to artificial intelligence. One, I'll attribute to Ada Lovelace, who in the 1830s and 40s, Lord Byron's daughter, who puts together the notion.
Who you also did a biography of.
Yeah, and she is great, and she loves both poetry like her dad and processors and math like her mother. And she says we'll be able to build machines that'll be general purpose, because she looks at the punch cards they're using for the looms. And she said they'll be able to do everything except think. It'll be humans that'll be creative and the machines that will be the processing power. Then you have Alan Turing, exactly 100 years later from when Ada published her paper, calling it Lady Lovelace's objection and saying with the imitation game. No, machines will be able to think just like humans. We won't be able to tell them apart. So the two schools of thought diverge, which is what I'll call the Ada Lovelace, Doug Engelbart, Alan Kay, Steve Jobs school, which is the combination of humans and machines will always outpace humans alone and machines alone in what they can do. And so if you have a symbiosis, a partnership of humans and machines, you'll be able to move faster and do more than what machines alone will be able to do. And the other school is sort of the Alan Turing singularity school, which is no, at a certain point, machines will leave us behind and not need us. I tend to look at the data, because I'm a historian, not a futurist, and say in every step of the way from 1830 to now, the Ada, Steve Jobs view has been correct, that the partnership of humans and machines ends up being more productive and more creative than the machines alone. And so that outpaces it, and will continue to do so.
And we'll continue to take more of your calls. Let me go next to Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks much for taking the call. Walter, this is Mike Moskowski. You don't remember me, but you and I sat on a committee at Time, Inc. to launch Pathfinder. To take.
Oh, my goodness, yes. The early days of the Internet.
They're at the creation. So I'm a great fan of your work. I have loved your biographies. Looking forward to reading this one. Curious about one thing we'd already mentioned earlier in the program, Leonardo's pacifism, and how it was an uneasy mix or match with the warlords that he served for a time. I'd heard a rumor that he had deliberately inserted certain errors into his designs for these war machines, such that in an era before patenting and the era of free copying, they would actually not be effective if put to use. Did you find any research that was actually true?
Yes, there's some truth to that. And it's, let's take that tank that somewhat famous, looks like a turtle, and it has people inside and guns pointing outward, and it's a big old shell of a tank, and it was considered to be the invention of the first tank. And Leonardo, being Leonardo, does all sorts of layered drawings, so you see each mechanism and how the mechanisms work. And one of the gears and cogs is reversed so that if you built it the exact way he drew it, one of the wheels would turn the wrong way, and thus the whole thing wouldn't work. There's some who say he did that. It was just a mistake. I'm not sure Leonardo made mistakes like that. He knew how gears and cogs worked. Others say he did it so nobody could steal it or build it and be effective. And that's the joy of Leonardo, is discovering tiny little things like that that you know were intentional. And he probably wanted to make sure that at least without his permission, nobody could build one of those things. Same with his underwater diving gear, which he thought would be a very dangerous weapon. He made it so that he didn't show all the details.
That reminds me could you say something about the way he wrote? Because there was a lot of controversy.
Yeah, he wrote in mirror script, meaning he, instead of from the left-hand part of the page to the right-hand part, he wrote from right to left with all the letters reversed. And that's
because for a while people thought it was a code or something.
Yeah, and I think it's mainly because he's left-handed, and you don't smear the ink if you're using your left hand and you go from the right part of the page to the left part of the page. And he does that even as a kid because he's an unusual person, which is he's not schooled, but he is literate. And so he writes the way he wants to because he wasn't taught to write with perfect penmanship. It also means that people can't look over his shoulder and see exactly what he said. But it was not really a code because if you tried, you could easily break the code. You just held a mirror up to it, or I've obviously looked at a lot of the notebooks, and if you work at it, you can read it backwards.
And speaking as being literate, in those notebooks, there's also a lot of parables and rhymes and all kinds of, well, literary
poetry,
yeah.
Stories. I think a lot of what he did was for the theater. That was his main job in his 20s and early 30s, and they put on performances at the court. And some of them are plays, some of them are stories that people declaim. And even that helicopter starts off, as I said, as a prop for a stage performance to bring the angels down from the rafters. So people sometimes mystified about what's this weird story in his notebook. And I'm sure it was for some grand evening performance at the Duke of Milan's court.
Let me go to more of our callers, and let's go next to Bill. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Sure. How wonderful to have Walter Isaacson in for this conversation, and what an important topic. I run the SETI Institute here in Mountain View, and we have 75 scientists whose work is to investigate the origins of life in the universe, and it's a multidisciplinary task. In addition to the scientists, we have an artist-in-residence program, which I'm so proud of and pleased of, and I'd be interested to, you know, it's a little bit like consilience, this convergence of art and science. Be interested in Walter's perspectives on how we build that awareness of the importance of that intersection in the technical community, in particular here in Silicon Valley, but also more broadly. We find that our artists very often, in spending time with our scientists and interpreting their work, give our scientists different perspectives that they never before realized about the work they do.
I think what you do is so important in that regard. And indeed, so many great technologists have, you know, benefited, whether from Einstein to Steve Jobs, from the connection to art. But I'm going to actually flip your question the other way, because most technologists and most engineers and most scientists I know, they actually like art. They have an appreciation for music, for beauty. They even go to Shakespeare plays or whatever. The problem is sometimes on the other side of the fence is that my friends who tell me, oh, it's so important for all these engineers to know art, I say, yeah, but you love the humanities and art. Do you know what a transistor does? Do you know what an on-off switch does in a circuit and how Boolean algebra can make a logical sequence? Do you understand what a mathematical equation, how to visualize it? And they go, oh, I don't do math. I don't understand physics. I don't like science.
There's even some contempt about math.
The contempt. They will brag. They never brag that they couldn't know the difference between Hamlet and Macbeth. But if they would sort of joke that they don't know the difference between, you know, a resistor and a capacitor, or they don't know the difference between a differential and a equation and an algebraic formula, and you think, all right, maybe instead of fighting to get the A into STEM so that you can have arts with science education, you should fight with those in your side, the humanists and the artists, to say, we should appreciate the beauty of science a bit more. That's what I learned from Ben Franklin, and that's what I learned from Leonardo.
Well, for a number of years, as my listeners know, I was involved in a science humanities convergence program that was funded by NEH and the Mellon Foundation. And what we try to do is, and I would make a sort of a little bit of a homily here, get artists and scientists together. That's what we did. You know, get them to talking about subjects of common influence. You know, now we got gene editing, you got all kinds of things along those lines that they can actually discuss and discuss from their different perspectives and learn from each other.
And exactly where creativity occurs is when there's that intersection. And people worry about our jobs of the future. And so they tell our kids, as my daughter majored in computer science, that they have to learn coding. And that's true. I mean, humanists who tell me, oh, they should learn Latin and Greek, I say, that's fine. But do you know Pascal or Python? You should understand those languages as well. However, if you just know the engineering, I think you might be left behind, because it is that partnership and symbiosis of creativity and technology. That's what Steve Jobs and Leonardo da Vinci and Ada Lovelace taught us, is where real innovation occurs.
There's a question that you probably get a lot, and it's in some ways an unfair question. I always say, who's your greatest interview? You know, all those kinds of things, and it's almost impossible. But when you talk about genius, and we've been talking about genius, who's the top of your pantheon? Is Leonardo above Einstein and Jobs, or is Jobs?
Yeah, Leonardo is sort of the culmination of these books I've been doing. I don't think I'll try to scale another mountain like this, because Leonardo is the ultimate in connecting art and science. Vitruvian Man is the icon of that. And the cool thing about him is that he wasn't touched by lightning the way Einstein or Newton was and have some processing power that we're never going to fathom. He did it by being self-taught, by being observant, by being curious, by being open to mystery, by blurring the line between fantasy and reality. All those things we can do if we allow ourselves to be more childlike and curious and observant. And so he's the one I had the most fun with. And to me, he's the person I've been building up to in my whole career.
It's a whole trajectory,
to say,
isn't it?
Yeah. Let's do Leonardo da Vinci.
So no more mountains to climb? No,
I think I'll write some other... I'm moving to New Orleans, my hometown, moving back home. I've always had a home there, actually. And I'm going to do something about race and class and jazz and music. But this Leonardo da Vinci book, to me, the beauty of the book, the way it's been printed, the way I try to bring together the science and the art, I think I'm going to leave that as the... culmination.
Well, I hope you will write more and be back with us again.
I hope I can come back, even if I write a smaller book.
Smaller book. You'll always be welcome, Walter. Walter Isaacson, again, CEO of the Aspen Institute and also the author of biographies of, Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, Henry Kissinger, and now Leonardo da Vinci. And he'll be at Kepler's this evening. You can actually meet him there. He'll be there at 7:30. In Menlo Park. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can, of course, continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. If all goes according to plan, we'll be back with you on tomorrow. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.